You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel.
Water bailiff Alex Campbell reports he's seen the Loch Ness Monster 18 times. His closest encounter came one night as he rowed in a boat with a policeman friend, Constable John Fraser.
There was this terrific upsurge of water. Terrific. I knew right away what it was. But poor John Fraser didn't, and he was scared stiff. And he said, "What in the name of heaven is that?" "Oh," I said, "don't worry, John, it's okay. We'll be okay." I said, "It's messy." "Oh," that calmed him down a bit. But this surge kept going on. And then after what seemed to be 2 or 3 minutes, the surge still going on, we heard it breathing. And it was fantastic itself, that, because it was sounded exactly like a horse that had been running. And it was sounded like this. Just like that.
Well, after that fantastic impression, I think you know what the topic of this week's show is going to be. Nessie, for the best part of a century, has certainly been the top dog for monsters of lochs, lakes, and the seas. And despite numerous attempts to pour cold water on anyone who believes in the Loch Ness Monster, her appeal remains undiminished. 2 years into the show, we finally tackle the UK's most famous cryptid in the company of author, researcher, investigator, and lecturer, Ken Gerhardt. Ken's brilliant new book, The Essential Guide to Loch Ness and Other Aquatic Cryptids, is a return to looking at the most beloved of water-based cryptids. Ken joins me to discuss Nessie's history, some notable sightings, the famous cryptozoologists who came to Loch Ness, and Ken's theory on what type of creature Nessie could possibly be. We also take a trip to Lake Champlain to look into Champ and cover Sandra Mansey's legendary photo, the long history of sightings, and the work current investigators like Katie Elizabeth are involved in, searching for Champ. A big thank you to Ken for joining me on this week's show. Now, we've got a request from one of our listeners, Mike, who runs the fabulous Beastwatch UK here in the UK. You can check their website out on www.beastwatch.uk. And currently, they're undergoing a Feed the Animals campaign. And at the moment, what they're doing is trying to support some of the smaller animal rescues and rehabbers who are reliant on donations here in the UK to help fund their activities and save animals' lives. With the number of volunteers and group members who are engaged in this invaluable service and form part of the close-knit network of emergency care and foster homes for the animals that they rescue, times have been tough for a lot of them. I'll put the link in this week's show notes so you can check out Mike and his team's great work and everything that Beastwatch UK get up to. Don't forget, you can check them at www.beastwatch.uk. As always, you can support the show with a donation of $4 a month, which will get you early access to all the episodes, bonus content, and much more. The link, as usual, is in this week's show notes as well. We're also on all social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and please subscribe to our YouTube channel. Search Mysteries and Monsters on YouTube. You can also find and follow our website at mysteriesandmonsters.com. As always, artwork for this week's show is done by Dean Bestall. The show is produced, as always, by Brennan Storr from the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, to the highlands of Scotland we go, in search of probably the most famous cryptid in the entire world, Nessie. It's been a while since we decided to take a trip into the world of lake and sea monsters, and our guide on this dangerous journey is Ken Gerhardt. It's been too long since Ken joined us for a proper chat, and what better time than with his fantastic new book hitting the shelves, The Essential Guide to Loch Ness and Other Aquatic Cryptids. Ken, delighted to welcome you back. How are we?
Hello, Paul. It's always good to speak to you, my friend. It's an honor and a pleasure to be with you as always.
Likewise. Been too long. I can't believe it's been nearly a year since we've had a proper episode together.
Yes, well, quite an unconventional year it's been, so that would explain a lot of things, but good to be back with you.
No, thank you, and thank you for your time as always. Now, when we've spoken before, we've mentioned Nessie, primarily Ken, because I would go as far to say, is this one of your first cryptid loves from that trip many years ago as a young man?
Oh, without question. I mean, by age 8 or 9, I was fully in on Bigfoot and cryptozoology. But my mother was an adventurous person, and she encouraged my interest and arranged for a fishing trip for my father and I up at Loch Ness when I was 15 years old back in 1982. My father and I went on a lot of wonderful fishing trips together, but that was probably the best of all for obvious reasons. And admittedly, Paul, we didn't do a lot of fishing. I spent most of my time. I had a little 8mm movie camera, and so I spent a lot of time kind of camped out at the lock, hoping that I would see some remarkable sight. And also I spent some time sort of speaking with many of the locals and trying to find out if anyone had seen the monster and so forth. So yeah, I think that was kind of an epiphany in my young life, because it kind of set me on the trail of unknown animals.
Yeah. Do you think this is a subject that you've been itching to get into properly? Because I know a lot of your books, you've kind of focused on the cryptids in the States. And then obviously last year we had the fantastic Essential Guide to Bigfoot came out. So was this a subject you've been wanting to tackle for quite a while, Ken?
Yes, without question, Paul. There are so many wonderful cryptids in the field to explore and investigate. And I finally got around to writing a Bigfoot book last year, which I'd been itching to do. But I'd always wanted to approach the subject of lake monsters and aquatic cryptids. I think they're greatly overlooked in this modern age of cryptozoology, whereas in the past they were kind of the focus in a lot of ways. And, I have done some traveling, not as much as I would have liked to through the years, but I've investigated lake monsters throughout North America and sea serpent sightings off the coast of Holland years ago. So I was actually hoping in the course of writing this new book that I might have an opportunity to return to Loch Ness this year. But of course, that was before the pandemic hit. So that kind of sunk those plans. But I was very fortunate to get in touch with some Nessie investigators on the other side of the pond, people like Steve Feltham and Roland Watson and Tony Harmsworth and some others. So that was very helpful.
Yeah. Well, Steve's obviously done the foreword for the book as to mirror what happened with the excellent Bigfoot book when you had the legend that is Peter Byrne introducing it. And Steve's one of those people that you've just got to admire his tenacity, because bless him, he's been part there for 30 years, there or thereabouts, doing what I think a lot of us, if we had the time and the money and the opportunity, Ken, I think a lot of us would do what Steve does.
Yeah, he's definitely an inspiration. I'd always looked up to him, had never had an opportunity to connect with him, which has been quite delightful. But there's a saying within the field of cryptozoology, Paul, that the two main elements to being a success are patience and passion. And I think Steve epitomizes both of those. He's, like you said, he's been camped along the lock for 30 plus years now, incredibly patient, and his great passion and enthusiasm for the subject is infectious. So, I really admire him, and it was an honor to have him write a foreword to the book.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I always enjoy your books anyway, Ken, because you're always very kind and considerate in your ability to bring the reader a bit of cryptozoological history. And the very first page in the book has a quote from someone who I have a lot of respect for, which was the wonderful cryptozoologist Roy P. McCall. And Roy is one of those people that I became very aware of around 8 or 9 years old, because he appeared on a TV show over here called Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was about to go hunting for Mekelia Mbembe back then.
Correct, yep.
And that was the first time. And then obviously I've been aware of Roy's work in regards to sort of water-based cryptids and dinosaurs from around that point. So when you're dealing with a book like this, Ken, is it difficult to kind of make sure you give the right appreciation to the people that have done this incredible amount of groundwork, or for somebody as well versed in the subject as yourself, is it a case of I have to mention these people and make sure people are fully aware of them?
Yeah, well, probably both. I mean, Dr. Mackle is one of my heroes within the field, along with Dr. Grover Krantz on the Bigfoot end, and Rupert T. Gould, who's a name that a lot of people haven't heard, but back in the 1930s, he investigated and wrote some excellent books about the Loch Ness Monster and also sea serpents. And so I think it's important for people that are coming into the field these days. They've sadly have forgotten a lot of the history and some of the names of pioneers and people that have walked before us.
Mm.
And in terms of Roy Mackle, as you mentioned, he was an adventurous guy. Came from a traditional scientific background as a biologist from the University of Chicago, a microbiologist actually. But he was on vacation in at Loch Ness in the late 60s, and he met some of the folks from the Loch Ness Investigation Bureau, and he fortunately got involved in that search. And I think, in my opinion, he really kind of upped the ante in terms of the scientific aspect of what was going on at that time, introduced a lot of methodology and new technology, raised funding, and did a lot of things that were very important at that time. So, I think the quote, which I took, I believe, from another television appearance that he had, you know, was very appropriate. And if I could read that, it's just, there should be no area of human experience that reasonable men and women shouldn't investigate. And I think that's a completely reasonable way to look at any subject, particularly some of these enduring mysteries.
Absolutely. So, Ken, for you, what do you think makes Nessie so special in the world of water-based cryptids? Because Nessie seems to be, and has been for a considerable period of time, top of the pile by a long shot.
Yes.
And yet, when we kind of look at and compare it to, say, Champ or Ogopogo, there's probably, well, I'm loath to say it, but you would suggest that perhaps there's more concrete evidence for one of those two rather than Nessie. So do you think, mm-hmm, Nessie's just got this romantic appeal because it was the first?
Well, technically, it wasn't the first in terms of, I think some of the Ogopogo sightings predated it, and even Champ sightings going back to the 19th century.
Mm.
I think it may have been the first in terms of really to get worldwide exposure via the media, newspaper articles and the like. And I think there are a number of sociological and cultural influences, Paul. One being that the year 1933, when Nessie first when Nessie sightings were first being reported and kind of made worldwide news, it was actually the same year that a movie called King Kong was released. And so I think monsters were just kind of a popular subject of the day. And, when people started hearing about these sightings at Loch Ness, it kind of created, as you suggest, a romantic view of, wow, there, you know, perhaps there is a real, you know, dragon, if you will, something, yes, lurking in this mysterious Scottish loch. And but beyond that, I think it's also the location.
Mm-hmm.
It's, if you've ever been to Loch Ness, I mean, it's it kind of typifies that romantic sort of Arthurian time, where you have these, you know, mist shrouded hills and old castle ruins and you know, so it's kind of, you know, it's a good location for kind of a what could be referred to as a veritable dragon, is what people are reporting in this this dark, mysterious loch. So and also I think some of the publicity that the Loch Ness Monster gained during the crucial time of the late 1960s and 1970s, when a number of these topics were becoming very popular throughout the world. And you had a number of scientific expeditions going on at Loch Ness. Still controversial, but intriguing photographs and sonar contacts and things like that made big news. So, and I think a lot of our, our cryptozoology culture of today, and perhaps the culture at large in terms of how we look at monster mysteries. I think we were all from that generation that were greatly influenced in the 1970s. That's kind of when Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and some of these things really came to the forefront.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, you're right. There's not perhaps not as much evidence. Now, there are allegedly at least 3,000 documented sightings. Hmm. You know, dating back, so that is quite a number of sightings, but you could make a very strong case for some of those other lakes that you're talking about as well, Lake Champlain, Lake Okanagan, and so forth.
Yeah. Well, as we speak, Nessie's made its alleged fifth appearance of the year, because obviously the thing about Loch Ness is that we've got webcams there as well, so a lot of people yes. tend to sit at home and just watch the loch all day as well, which is remarkable that it still has this appeal to people, Ken.
Yes, that's true. Really has captured the imagination. And one of the surprising things, one of the things that I think surprises people about the Loch Ness mystery, because, you know, since the book has come out, I've been asked quite a bit from people that weren't really aware. They say, oh, you know, have there been any sightings in recent years? I thought all that happened years and years ago. And I tell them, I say, actually, according to current Nessie investigators, there are about 10 good sightings a year on average still. So the sightings have continued. There are some remarkable sonar contacts that have been made, one just as recently as September 30th of last year, and the photographs, and those continue as well. Now, sadly, none of those have turned out to be conclusive. They're all sort of open for interpretation, but the webcams, I think, along the loch, I think that's also provided another interesting avenue of circumstantial evidence, because people can, as you said, anyone can be a Nessie investigator in the comfort of their own home these days. Just kind of sit back on the sofa and turn on your webcam.
Yeah, it's probably easier to keep an eye on Loch Ness than it is Lake Champlain, to be fair, Ken.
Oh, yeah. Loch Ness obviously is much smaller in terms of the area that needs to be watched. You're right about that. Yeah. Lake Champlain is huge. It's about over 100 miles long, and I forget how many miles across, 20 miles across or something like that. So it's massive. Mm. But something that Steve Feltham pointed out to me recently, which I thought was interesting, was that unless you've been to Loch Ness, it's hard to visualize how little of the lake is actually visible at any given time. I mean, there are certain areas that, you know, are, you know, highly trafficked by tourists and so forth. And there are certainly tourist boats out on the loch as well. Much of the lake is still obscured by heavy brush, steep hills, and steep cliffs and things like that. So, you know, it's not like you can just pop up to Loch Ness at any point and get a good view of the lake. Some of those areas are still fairly hidden from the public, if you will.
Yeah, and it's deep as well, Ken. I mean, that's the thing a lot of people don't realize about Loch Ness, is it is actually deeper than the English Channel, and I've been very fortunate to spend a few days in Loch Ness a few years ago. And it is a jaw-droppingly beautiful part of the British Isles. It is stunning, and when I was there, I was very fortunate that the weather was very kind to me. It was absolutely gorgeous throughout my time there.
Nice.
And I took a trip out onto the loch myself, and just did like most people do who have a love of cryptozoology, Ken. I just kind of wandered about drinking it all in.
Yeah, I can't wait to get back there, but I'm sure it would be an electric feeling just to be there. You know, it's such an iconic place, and, you know, as you said, I mean, the scenery is just stunning, and it just feels like there should be, even if there isn't, there should be a Loch Ness monster once you kind of get a taste of it. Like, and it's, you know, just the you mentioned the great depth, which is impressive. I mean, 754 feet deep has been the long accepted scientific depth reading, but there have been some unverified depth readings of over 800 feet. So who knows how deep it actually goes. 263 billion cubic feet of water, which is just a massive amount of water if you can wrap your head around it. But of course, most of that water is very dark, and you know that it's created a real challenge for all investigators through the years, because you have a lot of peat and sediment running down from the steep hills into the loch and rushing down, you know, coming down the river. And sunlight only penetrates about 10 feet on a bright sunny day. And it kind of adds to the mystery, and it's been a challenge for investigators through the years that have tried to use things like underwater cameras and so forth.
I think one of the other intriguing things about Nessie is that obviously the thing that's always struck me about this is some of the early reports, Ken, back in the 30s when Nessie hit the headlines, were notable for being on land.
Yeah.
I think the Spicer sighting is one that always comes to mind when you're considering these. And when you're looking into these kind of reports and creatures around the world, Ken, is Nessie the only one where we've kind of got this combination of land and lake or loch sightings?
Well, that's a good question. Now, I like to point out to people that although the alleged land sightings are very exciting, and we already use the word romantic, I mean, it's one thing to have a massive hump or humps rolling on the surface of the water, but then when somebody sees something crawling around on the shore, I guess that raises the intensity of the situation. With regard to the Loch Ness Monster, there have only been about 36 alleged land sightings through the years. So What do we say before in terms of overall sightings? 3,000?
Yeah.
So looking at it scientifically, looking at the data, in my own mind at least, that's such a small minutia of sightings that they're hardly worth, you know, considering with any great seriousness. But there have been land sightings of the Lake Champlain Monster, or CHAMP. There have been people that claim to have seen that on the shore, and at least a couple of investigators that have theories about the Lake Champlain monsters coming onto some of the marshy areas and swamps on the side of the loch. I'm not familiar with any of those types of sightings with regard to the Lake Okanagan Monster or Ogopogo. Nor thinking about it, can I really think of any land sightings involving any of the other major lake monsters that we know of from Scandinavia, Russia, Japan, Argentina, Ireland, and so forth. Oh, actually, Ireland, I guess I should say, is an exception, because you have the Irish lake monsters, and apparently there's a local name, which is Pisces. I don't know if I'm saying that exactly right, which are horse eels, is another kind of a common term, have said to have been seen crawling across the land briefly to get from lake to lake, and even getting stuck in culverts and under bridges. So I would say the three exceptions would be, again, Nessie, some of the Irish lake monsters, and the Lake Champlain Monster. But other than those, I haven't found any significant reports of lake monsters coming on shore.
Yeah, no, it was quite interesting, because I was watching an episode of Josh Gates's latest series, Expedition X, with his two intrepid explorers that he sends on these various missions, Phil Torres and Jessica Chabot. And they went and did a CHAMP sighting and came across some very unusual markings in a mud basin by the lakeside, which was obviously also coupled with a rather large splashing sound. So that's what intrigued me about that, because I'd never really kind of heard of that kind of aspect when it came to CHAMP. But as you refer to, I think sometimes people tend to focus on these two or three sightings in the 30s about Nessie to have come through to this kind of, well, it must be an amphibian then.
Yeah, the Spicer sighting, which you mentioned, was one of the stories that really launched Nessie into the headlines at the latter part of 1933. And I'm sure most of your listeners have heard about it, but on July 22nd, 1933, in the afternoon, a gentleman named George Spicer, who was an executive of a tailoring firm from London, was on holiday with his wife, and they were motoring along Loch Ness on the way home. And according to them both, they saw something sort of emerge from the brush on the hill ahead of them, across the road, in what they described as kind of a loathsome jerking motion. And they described it as repulsive, an abomination. It had kind of a wormy, creepy look to it. Mm. And it just kind of slithered across the road and then slid down an embankment back into Loch Ness. And this story it wasn't publicized right away, Paul. George Spicer ultimately wrote some letters, I believe, to the Inverness Courier and perhaps to the Daily Mail there in London, talking about his sighting. And this was, of course, just after some of the first publicized sightings of Nessie had, you know, had taken place earlier in 1933. So it's quite a dramatic, you know, if you try to envision that, it all sounds very dramatic, right? I mean, there's a couple just motoring down the road in the afternoon, and suddenly this monster lunges across the road in front of them and slides down into Loch Ness. So I think that account certainly captured the public's imagination. And then soon thereafter, in January of 1934, there was another account where a young man named Arthur Grant, he was on a motorcycle, and this time it was in the middle of the night. I think it was like 1 a.m. And he was a veterinary student and was motoring home along the northeast side of Loch Ness back towards Inverness, and claims that basically, similar to the Spicers, that there was this creature kind of right there on the side of the road. And so he had, you know, ultimately reported that as well. And so that, you know, that was another dramatic, you know, kind of encounter that. So I think those two, I think, really kind of started the whole notion of Nessie land sightings. And again, this was early on in the game. So I think people were more impressionable at that point in terms of what we were looking at with regard to the Loch Ness Monster. But through the years, there have been very few land sightings, or at least reported land sightings. And logically speaking, Paul, I think we could all assume that if the Loch Ness Monster was an amphibian and was coming onto shore, certainly there would be more sightings or more proof by now.
Yeah, very true. And I think it's one of those things that I still find it interesting that people still refer to these early sightings, Ken, because like you say, I'm not aware of anything in the modern era that even mirrors anything that Spicer and Grant saw. And it's odd that people will still go back to those, whereas, the as you say, over 3,000 sightings, the vast majority are all based in and around the Loch in specific areas, aren't they?
Yes, true. And also you have to look at weather conditions. So it seems like the majority of Nessie sightings occurred during the hot summer months, when the surface of the loch is relatively flat. In fact, you hear many descriptions, people that have had sightings often describe the water as, you know, the surface of a mirror, you know, flat and calm and so on and so forth. Which is interesting, because it would indicate that whatever the Loch Ness Monster is or represents, perhaps it's simply just not an animal that feels the need to surface very often, or only does so under the right conditions, and would explain why perhaps there are not more sightings than there are.
Yeah. And the other thing as well is that Loch Ness had a spurt of sightings when the new road opened as well, Ken, because a lot of people say, oh, well, yeah, all these sightings all happened in the modern era. Well, obviously, because before this new road opened, it was a very ramshackle journey. It wasn't something that – it was the kind of road you would only use if you had to.
Yes, there was a road that moved along the south side of the loch, and it was kind of a – you know, it was a very difficult passage, from what I understand. And it didn't exactly hug the side of the loch either. It kind of twisted away, you know, because there is a lot of brush and vegetation and forested areas. So visibility of the loch from the south side was challenging even back then. And then in, as you mentioned, in 1933, they opened this A82, which runs pretty much right along the northern edge of the loch. It does diverge in a couple of spots, but and then the other element is that in order to build this new road, they had actually cleared a lot of brush away from the loch. So whereas the loch was hidden by brush on both sides, now from the north side you had much better visibility than anyone had ever had before. And coincidentally, that's when the sightings of the Loch Ness Monster really began to take get noticed. Were in the early 1933. The first sighting, of course, in April of 1933 by the Mackays, Aldie Mackay and her husband. Probably the first notable sighting and the first time we ever heard the name Monster, Loch Ness Monster, used by the Inverness Courier. But a number of sightings in 1933 and 34, those were the big years. The sightings do continue, as we say, but you know, you can certainly make a case that there were reasons that there were so many sightings back at that time period, because I think a lot of that brush has probably grown back over the years and not been cleared away to that extent. So,
And as with anything, Ken, I think often people turn up at Loch Ness on the off chance and presume that they're going to see Nessie, whereas, as we know, the one thing that cryptozoology always asks for is extreme patience.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, look at the example of Steve Felton, who we just talked about. I mean, he's been camped along the loch for 30 years, 30 plus years, binoculars in hand. He's got a telescope. He has cameras. And he's only had one sighting. And that was the very first year that he showed up. I think within the first month, he saw a mysterious large hump surface. And according to Steve, that, you know, he was immediately thinking, oh, this is going to be easy. I'm going to solve this in no time because I've already had my first sighting. within a month.
Yep.
And then all these years later, he's been waiting for a second. So so it just really, you know, it bears out the reality that if the Loch Ness Monster exists, for whatever reasons, it doesn't surface very often. And when it does, it's just a matter of pure chance or luck that someone's in the right place at the right time and sees it. So now, you know, of course, you can make a pretty strong skeptical argument to that statement and say, well, it just doesn't make sense that, you know, that there aren't more sightings. If there's a large animal in Loch Ness, whatever it is, you know, over all these years and, you know, someone like Steve looking out all day for 30 years, that you would see it more often. But, you know, that's kind of the paradox, if you will, with regard to the Loch Ness mystery. You can make strong arguments on either side of that.
Yeah, and I think one of the other interesting aspects of your book, Ken, is that you've not fallen into the usual explanations, because I've seen a few reviews where people seem to be very surprised in the way that you've looked at a possible explanation, because most people used to often say that this has to be a plesiosaur or some kind of relic dinosaur that somehow managed to survive millions and millions of years. And then I would imagine over the last sort of 20 or 30 years, people have kind of moved towards it being some kind of large eel of some description. In regards to your point, because I believe you're kind of moving towards it perhaps being some kind of relative or evolved version of a bacillosaur. In what regards did you decide to tackle it from that end, Ken? Because it would have been very easy for you to have just dropped into the normal camp, I suspect.
Well, you know, I certainly respect any investigator that, you know, like people like Tim Dinsdale, who spent so many years at Loch Ness, and he was a strong advocate for the plesiosaur theory. The surgeon's photo, I think, had a lot to do with that. In the, sort of that image of Nessie that we all had, the famous surgeon's photo of 1934, you know, the classic head and neck poking out of the water certainly looked like a plesiosaur. And I think that more than anything else, and some of the other head and neck sightings kind of forged, and also the land sightings we just discussed, because what the Spicers described and what Arthur Grant described and sketched certainly appeared to be very plesiosaur-like. So it has been a strong theory for many years, kind of a favored theory, if you will. And I think there's a history there too, Paul, because if you go back to the mid-19th century, when so-called sea serpents were being reported in the world's oceans and made a lot of newspaper headlines around the world, some of the first zoologists that chimed in on that suggested that plesiosaurs might be a possibility. And that perhaps is connected to kind of the burgeoning paleontology field that was happening at that time. And a number of plesiosaur fossils were being discovered at places like Dorset and elsewhere throughout the UK. So there are a number of factors involved there. But, going back to Dr. Roy Mackel, who's written probably the best book on the Loch Ness Monster, from a very scientific perspective, he actually spent a lot of time looking at all of the aspects of potential candidates for the Loch Ness Monster, not just the physical characteristics that have been described by various eyewitnesses, but also the biological requirements that, you know, certain different types of species, what they would require and display and so forth. And so he actually had a rating system for candidates, potential candidates for the Loch Ness Monster, and rating very low on his chart were plesiosaurs for a number of reasons. The water is very cold. It maintains a constant temperature of around 42 degrees Fahrenheit, which you would not expect a reptile to thrive in that type of environment. Also, reptiles tend to be heavy air breathers, even aquatic reptiles like crocodilians and things will surface quite a bit to breathe. The three candidates ranked very high on his scale. The top-ranking candidate was some type of giant amphibian, something that could, you know, breathe essentially through its skin, because aquatic salamanders can do something called cutaneous respiration, where they don't have to – they do have lungs, but they don't necessarily have to swim to the surface and take a gulp of air all the time like reptiles do. They can actually float on the bottom and adapt that way. And also, amphibians are more acclimated to cold water than reptiles are. The second leading candidate, and I think tied for second, were giant eels, which Mackel has advocated that theory on a number of occasions, and that's a kind of a popular theory these days as well. And also the bacillosaur theory. These bacillosaurs were ancient whales. They were kind of a side branch in whale evolution. They were very slender and snake-like, very long, you know, very long vertebral column. And presumably they vertically undulated. It's a tongue twister.
Yes.
They vertically undulated through the water, which is a specifically a mammalian characteristic when you look at things like pinnipeds, seals, otters, and so forth. So, and that's what most of the eyewitnesses describe, not only in Loch Ness, but around the world. When they see these things, they say these things are vertically undulating up and down through the water, which is a very distinct motion compared to fish and reptiles, which move side to side or horizontally. And also, when you look at the cold temperatures, we talked about that. You know, obviously mammals, there are a number of examples where aquatic mammals are well adapted to cold water. And also, you know, you could consider the fact that whales and other cetaceans and even dolphins, porpoises, will sometimes come into freshwater environments.
Yeah.
There have been whales sighted in the Thames River, for example, and the St. Lawrence River. And there are freshwater species of dolphins in China and South America. So so I think there's a lot to be made for that theory. Now, the arguments against, again, would be the air breathing, because, you know, all mammals are air breathers. So you would certainly expect that if there were these prehistoric whales frequenting lakes around the world, that they might be seen more often as they come up to gulp air. My only counter to that is that there are some whale species that are known to hold their breath for incredible lengths of time. For example, there was a recent study in 2017 where a type of beaked whale, also known as a ziphioid, was being monitored by scientists, and it actually held its breath for close to 4 hours before it came up for air, which is a pretty long span of time. So, so in my mind, and I do suggest the theory in the book, Paul, that the Loch Ness Monster, if it exists, and all these other lake monsters, could certainly be something that had descended from these ancient bacillosaur whales. But I try to tread lightly and not push that theory too hard, because I always like for my readers to remain objective and to form their own judgments and opinions.
Absolutely. But I think it's a worthy aspect of the case, Ken, because I think often we can get bogged down, and as you refer to, I think a lot of the plesiosaur versions are people referring to the surgeon's photo, which I think is a bit of a red herring, regardless of what people may think of its origins. And I think that has kind of twisted people's perception of what they expect to see rather than what they probably have seen.
Yes, that's true. We are very prone. All humans are very prone to have our biases, aren't we? We're very biased individuals based on our experiences and upbringings and so forth. Now, I'm sure that most of your listeners are educated enough to know that the surgeon's photo has been declared a likely hoax based on a revelation that happened in 1994. Two intrepid Nessie investigators tracked down a guy named Christian Sperling, who claimed that, you know, he was involved in this great hoax that happened back in 1934 when a dinosaur-like head and neck were attached to a toy submarine, floated out in the lock. They took some photos. They had a front man who was a British surgeon, Robert Kenneth Wilson, who took the photos in to be developed, and the whole thing kind of, you know. And again, the photo was quite remarkable. It was published on the front page of the Daily Mail back in 1934, and it really, you know, since that time, the surgeon's photo has appeared in pretty much every television show, pretty much in every Loch Ness book, you know. So it's an iconic image that a lot of people have really connected to the mystery. But in 1994, strong evidence surfaced that it was, in fact, a hoax. Now, I should point out that perhaps the world's two leading cryptozoologists, in my opinion, Lauren Coleman and Dr. Carl Shuker, are both skeptical of the hoax claim.
Yeah.
And they think that the hoax claim is in itself most likely a hoax.
Yes.
So there, you know, again, there's never anything that's sort of neat and tidy in this field. There are always kind of these controversies within controversies, if you will. And I'm kind of on the side. I think that there's enough evidence that the surgeon's photo very well may have been a hoax. In fact, for investigators that, you know, dig a little bit deeper into the history, and, you know, of course, one of the iconic Nessie books is More Than a Legend by Constance White, which was published in the late 1950s. She was a woman who had grown up around the loch, knew many of the locals, and, you know, even dating back to that time period, there were already rumors and murmurs that the surgeon's photo was a hoax back in the day. But that was just kind of all forgotten over the years. So, you know, to me, that's a little bit of a red flag, you know, if people are talking about that it was, quote unquote, something had been placed in the lock and towed along with a string or something along those lines.
Yes.
You know? So,
yeah.
But who knows? You know, you could make a case, certainly, or at least Shuker and Coleman have, that there are elements of the hoax claim that are troubling.
Yes. Well, very interestingly, I used to be, when I was a young man, I used to look at on that photo as concrete proof, Ken. It was evidence of Nessie being alive. And then obviously diving into this subject properly in the mid-90s and onwards, I was aware of the allegations from Sperling that it was a hoax. However, over the last couple of years, having got to know both Lauren and Dr. Carl Shuker, I'm also beginning to be troubled by this hoax explanation, because as Carl said, if you can't prove how the hoax was done, how can it be a hoax? Which I think is a very valid point to have. And the other day, I think he was actually having a discussion on Facebook with Steve Felton about this very image. And it's one of those where you just sit back and let the experts talk about these things, Ken. It was remarkably enjoyable.
Oh, yeah. Well, Carl is a brilliant guy. I mean, no doubt. And Lauren is as well. And they both certainly have been studying this this mystery, you know, for many decades. So, I think I have seen Alistair Boyd, who was one of the investigators who revealed the hoax theory in the 90s. I've seen him do a recreation on television where he had and I think Adrian Shine also has a recreation of this alleged submarine dinosaur model contraption, and they floated it out in the lock, and it did look, you know, very similar to the surgeon's photo. But I think Carl has a strong argument in terms of, I don't think it's been proven conclusively that the materials were available to make that back in 1934. You know, these are modern interpretations of what was done at that time. But, you know, did such a toy submarine exist? Did the, you know, was the expertise there to kind of cobble this thing together and to make it look convincing? So we'll never know for sure. But I think that the lesson to be learned, Paul, is that we should not put our faith in one singular piece of evidence, or too much faith in one singular piece of evidence. Rather, the pragmatic thing to do is to step back and look at everything as a whole. You know, there's a lot of evidence or alleged evidence with regard to the Loch Ness Monster, the surgeon's photo just being a tiny part of that.
Yeah, very true. And I'm surprised it took us so long to mention Adrian Shine as well, Ken, to be fair.
Yeah, I've never met Adrian. I was unsuccessful connecting with him for the course of my book. But I've, you know, I've read some of his articles, and he's written some excellent papers on the biology and ecosystem in Loch Ness. And he runs a remarkable exhibition up there in Drumna Drochet. And he's been involved in the investigation dating back to the early 1970s when he first went up to Lake. What am I thinking of? The lake up there. Morag.
Oh, yeah.
The monster.
Loch Moray.
Moray, yeah. So he became involved in the early 70s there, didn't have much success, moved over to Loch Ness, and he's been there for years. And, of course, he organized Operation Deep Scan in 1987, which was a very bold attempt to sweep the loch with a number of – a flotilla of 25 sonar-equipped boats. And You know, he's become over the years kind of known as a Nessie skeptic.
Yeah.
He is still very fascinated by the loch itself, by the biology, and there are a number of mysteries there to be explored. But I think he's made it clear that he's pretty skeptical in terms of the reality that there could actually be something like the Loch Ness Monster. Although he has also suggested that, you know, he wouldn't rule out the possibility of a large fish like a sturgeon, or an eel or something along those lines. So, yeah, but, you know, I think he's brought a lot to the table in terms of, you know, it's all about keeping that balance, Paul. So I respect. I respect anybody that is involved in investigating a mystery and is able to maintain their, you know, kind of an objective and critically thinking approach, you know, critical thinking approach. I have a number of friends, in fact, who are, you know, well-known skeptics, who are constantly on TV shows debunking things like Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. And I respect them greatly.
Yes.
Because I think it's important to have that balance. You can't certainly, you know, we just, a moment ago, we were talking about biases and, I think it goes without saying that all of us want the Loch Ness Monster to exist. That goes without saying that we would love for there to be some large, mysterious beastie in Loch Ness. and there is evidence that there is, but there are also strong arguments against. And, you know, that those are the ingredients for a great mystery.
Very true. Very true. And I think it leads us very nicely in regards to controversial photographic evidence, Ken. I think probably the most other notable alleged photo of a lake monster has to be Sandra Mansi's picture of what is supposedly Champ.
Yes, and very similar to the surgeon's photo, isn't it? In terms of the kind of the form and makeup of the photo, which I think is one of the things that gave it a lot of, you know, that garnered it a lot of media attention as well. But yes, the Sandra Mansi photo is considered by most cryptozoologists to be the most convincing still photograph of a lake monster. It was taken in July of 1977 by a woman named Sandra Mansi, who grew up in that area, and she was vacationing with her family at the time. They had gone down to a point on Lake Champlain, sort of on the northeastern end, the Vermont side, and according to Sandra's account, the kids were kind of wading out into the water playing. Her fiance had run back to the car to get a camera and some sunglasses. And as she was sitting there, she saw this thing, according to her, emerged from the lake, and you know, she said it basically looked like a dinosaur. It had a small head and a long neck and a hump, and it was turning its head around and opening its mouth. And right about this time, her fiance returned from the car, and he was horrified, and they got the kids out of the water and sort of chased them back up to the car. But before she left the scene, Sandra had the wherewithal to drop down to a knee and take a photograph, one still photograph, on this little Instamatic camera. When they got back in the car, they debated whether or not they should drive straight to the, you know, the sheriff's office and file a report, because they thought this thing could be dangerous and felt like the authorities should be warned. But as with many monster witnesses, they probably thought the better of it and thought, yes, well, people might think we're nuts, or, you know, they might lock us away.
Mm-hmm.
Throw away the keys. So they actually kept the photo in a photo album, family photo album, for a couple of years, until Sandra ran into a co-employee at work who had expressed an interest in the Loch Ness mystery, wanted to travel to Loch Ness. And she said, well, we've got something like that right here in Lake Champlain. And she brought the photo up to work. Well, it wasn't long, Paul, before some cryptozoologists got their hands on the photo. Mm-hmm. They'd gotten in touch with Sandra. And within a year or two, the photo was blasted on the front page of the New York Times, in Times Magazine, and you know, a number of places. So it's a color photograph. It's a still. It certainly does seem to show a large, I mean, you know, even though it's hard to judge scale exactly, it seems to be an extremely large animal poking its tiny head and long neck out of Lake Champlain. There's a large hump visible. It seems to have its head sort of turned or cocked to one side. It's been very hard for scientists and academics to explain away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as great cryptozoologist Richard Greenwell once said, well, if it doesn't show a monster, I'd like to know what it shows then.
Yes.
Because it certainly, you know, it certainly doesn't match the description of any known animal that you would expect to see in Lake Champlain. So but again, it's you know, still controversial after all these years. And there's at least one strong skeptical argument from Ben Radford.
Yes.
One of my skeptical buddies, that perhaps what Sandra photographed that day was simply a large tree, you know, or branch or something that looked sort of like a monster's head and neck, and had just floated up to the top of the loch there. And he interviewed Sandra Mansi. I never had the opportunity, unfortunately, before she passed. But
yeah,
Ben interviewed her at length and said that she was very sincere. And he was convinced that she believed that was actually what she had seen and photographed that day, was a monster,
yeah,
or the Lake Champlain animal. But he had his doubts about that. Now, I'm not sure that I'm on board with his theory either, because, you know, if Sandra claims that this thing was animated and moving around, and I'm not sure I've ever seen, you know, and I've spent a lot of times at lakes and, you know, along rivers and waterways throughout the world, I've never seen anything quite like you know, a plesiosaur head or a neck and a head shaped branch or tree, at least to that extent. So I don't know. It's, you know, it's controversial. But hopefully with better technology, you know, on mobile phone cameras and things like that, maybe we'll get better photographic evidence at some point.
Yeah, I would imagine you can read my mind, Ken, because I was literally about to mention Ben and his tree stump theory.
Yeah, well, I didn't mean to steal your thunder. Do you have any other thoughts on his theory? What are your thoughts on that, Paul?
Well, I'm the same as you. I think if you think of it as a tree stump that's upturned and is literally just bobbing past, yeah, fair enough, I can see that. But when you look at Sandra's version and what she explains, then clearly it's not a tree stump, because this thing was waving its head about and she saw it open its mouth, move from left to right. I'm not aware of a tree stump that can do that kind of thing. And that's exactly what your point was there, Ken. I agree in that regard, that if Sandra's version of events happened, and I'm not disputing that because I've seen her interviewed numerous times before her sad passing a couple of years ago, she always struck me as an extremely sincere witness, who, if anything, regretted the fact that she'd taken this photo with the amount of controversy, yes, and criticism she got, because I've seen her several times saying she wished she'd never taken it.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? I mean, that's another aspect to the mist, you know, that the fact that she was harassed and got so much grief, you know, about that through the years. And one last point to make regarding that theory is that, you know, if it ascended out of the water as she described, then it would have to be due to what Ben described as, you know, that these great tree trunks, you know, they're rotting and decomposing on the bottom of the lake, they get filled up with gas and then they're sort of propelled or shot up to the surface. And so, you know, to me that becomes problematic too, because, you know, did this thing just manage to shoot up at the exact moment that Sandra was sitting there and it just happened to, you know, conveniently look like a dinosaur, you know, and they're just, you know, to me, it just seems as unlikely, you know, as the alternative that all of those, it would be a perfect storm if all that happened right at that moment. So I don't know, but you know, you make another good point with regard to the ridicule. And I immediately thought of my friend Bob Gimlin, who, along with Roger Patterson, filmed the famous Bigfoot footage back in October of 1967. And, I've been fortunate to get to know Bob Gimlin through the years. And, you know, he got a lot of grief. You know, he actually, disassociated himself from that film shortly after it was released by Roger Patterson because he was getting so much grief and his wife was going to leave him. And, you know, it's not a pleasant thing to go through when somebody, who has obtained some of this sort of startling evidence says, just decides to put their, you know, put themselves out there, in the spotlight. I think, you know, you would wonder why someone would put themselves through all that kind of grief.
Yeah, absolutely, because I think you're painting a target on your back from both skeptics and cryptozoologists, because as someone that's got to know yourself, Ken, and others in the field over the last 3 or 4 years, I notice occasionally people will want to make their name by attacking people like Bob Gimlin or Sandra Mansi, because then they're basically riding on the back of that person's alleged experience by saying, oh, well, I disagree with it. I think it's a hoax.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And to that same point, I really, Paul, I put a lot more credibility in some of the older sightings of any cryptid, from the Loch Ness Monster to Bigfoot. When you think about the days back in the 1970s, for example, when people would have a sighting and they would report it to the police, and then it would end up in the newspaper because the media got hold of it. And, you know, suddenly their name is published in newspapers as an eyewitness of a Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster. And, you know, those folks back, to me, that, you know, to me, that adds a lot more credibility to a sighting when somebody is willing to attach their name to it and, you know, jeopardize legal repercussions by reporting it to the police if it's a fabrication, or, you know, putting their name in the newspaper. You know, sadly, in this day and age, many alleged eyewitnesses of, you know, cryptid eyewitnesses will just post it on a website or, you know, on a Facebook group. And, you know, that's not really, you're not really taking much of a chance there in terms of, you know, really opening yourself up to criticism. So,
yeah, especially if you've got a red ring about around your picture as well, Ken. That doesn't tend to help the argument.
I find. That's definitely a red flag, mate.
So, I mean, Champ is one of those as well, because it, once again, you've got that kind of criticism that a lot of people, if they don't really look at these experiences and these cryptids, Ken, they all suspect that they're all modern arrivals. Mm-hmm. Whereas Champ, as we touched on right at the beginning, is one of those where we've got a long history of sightings, you know, notable sightings, especially from the end of the 19th century. I'm thinking Captain Crumb is a prime example of a fantastic sighting where he's either lying or it happened.
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, you could go before that, Paul. I mean, you had Native American legends of a strange creature in the loch. Horned serpents is how they were described, which one local name was Tatiscock, and it was basically a giant serpentine animal with horns. So these are Native American legends that predated the white man. But you're right. Sightings of the Lake Champlain Monster do go back to the early 19th century and Captain Crumb. Now, granted, Captain Crumb's description is a little bit whimsical, but you could perhaps say that that's because of the newspapers, you know, embellishing the story, or, you know, making it perhaps a little bit more exciting for the readers. And then in 1915, there was a famous incident where the SS Ticonderoga, several passengers on board claimed that they saw a head and neck emerged from the water. So, you know, that's a good century before Nessie was ever reported to the newspapers. And so, yeah, so there have been – now, in the 1870s, P.T. Barnum, the famous showman, actually put out a bounty on the Lake Champlain monster because of the number of sightings that were being reported around that time period in the 1870s. So, so yeah, there's a pretty rich history at Lake Champlain that a lot of people aren't familiar with. Champ never seemed to get the type of publicity in the 20th century that Nessie did until perhaps the late 1970s when the Sandra Mancy photo came out. And around that same time period, there was a cryptozoologist named Joe Zarzynski who, you know, who was very active at Lake Champlain and kind of brought the Lake Champlain monster back into the spotlight. So, so yeah, you know, but you can find that with a lot of these lake monsters. I mean, Ogopogo, the Lake Okanagan monster in Canada, you know, you have sightings dating back to the 1920s. And then I think in some of the Scandinavian lakes. You know, the Lake Storsjö in Sweden, you have lake monster sightings from the late 19th century. So, So some of these stories go back quite a long time.
Yeah. And I mean, Champ's one as well, because obviously I've got to know Katie Elizabeth, who's another researcher who has essentially given her life for her love of Champ, which I think was born through watching Unsolved Mysteries in the 90s, Ken.
Yes, it was. That's what she told me as well.
Yeah, so Katie's obviously moved there for some parts of the year and spends the same kind of thing, but Katie's managed to catch some very weird sonar reports and things like that, and she seems to be making some real diligent efforts to kind of prove, once again, I don't think Katie's in that kind of it's a long lost dinosaur. I think Katie's kind of thinking there's something to this. I'm not sure what it is, but I know it's probably not a dinosaur.
Well, she has a new book out, and it looks very thorough. So she certainly has covered a lot of area. She is, as you said, very passionate, similar to Steve Feltham. And I kind of look at her as a female Tim Dinsdale because she spends a lot of time out on the lake. She has a boat and good sonar equipment and stuff. So, yeah, she's a good example of a very dedicated Champ researcher. And as you said, she did have an interesting sonar contact there. Trying to remember, it was just a couple of years ago. I think it was 2019. She recorded two huge elongate animate objects as she was motoring back to put some fuel back in her boat, motoring back to the dock. And they look very similar to some of the sonar contacts in Loch Ness that have been made, you know, in terms of just a long 20 to 30 foot animate thing, solid object swimming around down there. So that is rather impressive evidence. I don't know. Yeah, I did interview Katie, was one of the researchers that I investigated for my Loch Ness book because I wanted to get her take on the Loch Ness monster. I don't know if she's completely sold on the reptile theory. She's probably a little bit open-minded with regard to that. But she did suggest to me that she thinks that the Lake Champlain monster is ectothermic or cold-blooded. Which would suggest either a reptilian or an amphibian. And she's also one of the people that's documented and believes that there are a number of land sightings or shore sightings with the Lake Champlain monster, that these creatures might actually come onto the shore to, who knows, to lay their eggs or something along those lines. So I can't say where her head is at this moment, but I think she's probably leaning more towards a reptilian or amphibian identity. I don't know that she would go so far as to suggest it's a quote-unquote dinosaur of any kind. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, well, Katie's long overdue for coming back on the show anyway, so I keep meaning to pin her down to come back because I'd love to dive into it again with her because she was on one of my very earliest episodes and she's somebody who I've got a lot of time for in the regards to her diligent research, Ken.
Yeah, well, it would be a good time because, like I said, she just came out with her new Lake Champlain book, and you know, it's impressive. It's well put together, and I can tell she was very thorough in terms of covering a lot of different aspects regarding the Lake Champlain mystery.
Fantastic. Well, Ken, I could talk lake monsters and monsters in general with you till the cows come home, but I appreciate you've probably got a life to lead outside of speaking with me, my friend. So it'd be remiss of me, as always, to not mention another wonderful cover by Sam Sheeran as well. That's just a wonderful, wonderful cover of that poor man being terrified to death.
Yeah, I was very lucky to have Sam did the cover art for my Essential Guide to Bigfoot, which was just phenomenal, and he's so gifted. Yeah, it was actually very fortunate, Paul, because when I reached out to Sam to do the cover for the Loch Ness book, he had said, believe it or not, he had never done Loch Ness or Nessie artwork, despite the fact that he's done so many other cryptids. He's a huge cryptid enthusiast, so he had a lot of sort of pent-up inspiration.
Yeah.
And he was very excited because he said it had always been a dream to do a Nessie. So that was exciting for me as well. And I knew it would turn out as wonderfully as it did.
Before I let you go, Ken, the one last thing I want to mention is obviously you're often to be found at San Antonio Zoo.
Yes.
I believe you've had some dinosaurs delivered there.
Well, not just dinosaurs, but dragons, Paul.
Oh, wow.
We're right now doing a twofold. Thank you for mentioning this, by the way. I am a volunteer educator at the San Antonio Zoo. We're doing a dinosaur exhibit at the zoo itself, which includes 15 or so animatronic full-size dinosaurs of various species, T-Rex, Velociraptors, Triceratops, and all of the favorites.
Wow.
But just off-site, we've also opened a new exhibit called Dragon Garden, which features 15 life-size animatronic dragons representing dragon myths from all over the world. And they've graciously asked me to be involved in interpreting those exhibits and also in doing a dragon tour, which I did the first one this past Friday, where basically I led a group around this forested area where all these different dragons were lurking and gave the backstory behind each dragon legend, which is really fun and interesting. And dragons, of course, have captured the imagination of pretty much everybody on the planet. But, dragons are without a doubt the most widespread creature legends around the globe. You know, you have different types of mythologies arising from every corner of the globe. And they all incorporate elements of all of the scariest animals, serpents and winged things and, terrifying lions and tigers. And so they're a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying that at the moment.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, it looked brilliant. The pictures you shared looked fantastic. So I'm very jealous that I'm not anywhere near there.
Maybe they'll go on a world tour. Or maybe you need to pop over here to this side of the pond, Paul, and come give us a visit.
Absolutely. My return visit to the States is long overdue, Ken, and obviously now I have no excuse. I've made numerous friends over there, so I've got many a monster hunting invitation, so it would be remiss of me not to go to San Antonio, I suspect.
Well, fantastic. Well, if you get down to San Antonio, come pay me a visit. We can go by the zoo. We have one of the oldest Komodo dragons in captivity. His name is Bubba. He's 27 years old, and he's really a special guy.
Fantastic. Brilliant. So, Ken, where can everybody get hold of your wonderful Essential Guide to the Loch Ness Monster and other aquatic cryptids, amongst your other work?
Well, thanks again for having me on, Paul. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Some really wonderful conversation. Great questions, as always. The book is available on Amazon worldwide, so you can find it on Amazon.com. Just type up my name, Ken Gerhardt, and it'll take you to my author page. If anyone's interested in a signed copy, I sell those directly. And people can contact me through social media. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Brilliant. Fantastic. And obviously, I noticed the Essential Guide to Bigfoot was re-released by Beyond the Fray as well.
Well, they've done the Kindle version.
Fabulous.
They are doing the Kindle or digital versions of both the Loch Ness book and the Bigfoot book.
Brilliant.
They've also produced an audiobook version now of the Essential Guide to Bigfoot, which is being narrated by a world-class voice actor, narrator. We haven't decided yet to do if we're going to do an audio version of the Loch Ness book. But yes, I'm working with Beyond the Fray, and it's been wonderful working with them.
And lastly, before I let you leave, what's your potential next adventure or writing project then, Ken? What are you going to cast your eye upon next, my friend?
Oh, gosh. Everyone keeps asking me about my next book, which, when you've been through the process, Paul, of putting one out. Now, granted, I'm not a Nick Redfern. Nick is my best friend, and he writes three books a year to my one. So he really puts me to shame, but he's unbelievable. But I am juggling about 12 projects at the current time. I have a number of lectures coming up at different Bigfoot and cryptozoology conferences around the country. Mm-hmm. I've got a couple of expeditions planned, including a search for the giant salamanders of Northern California this July.
Oh.
And some possible television work, and I'm co-producing a Bigfoot documentary. So, I have a lot of irons in the fire at the moment.
Fantastic. Well, as always, I look forward to anything you're involved in, Ken, and I wish you the very best of luck. It's a fantastic book and a well-deserved addition to my lake and sea monster library. So thank you as always, and I wish you the very best of luck. Stay safe for the rest of the year, and hopefully we will speak sooner rather than later.
Sounds good, Paul. You take care as well, and we'll talk soon.